Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating Atlanta's heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of Atlanta's elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Well, good morning. It's a glorious Wednesday morning in December. It's going to get into the 60s today, an unusual day in December. We have Sam Grass in the studio with us and Stone Payton filling in for Lee Cantor as our producer this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Brad.
Good morning.
You all doing all right this morning?
Yeah.
Doing great. It is a beautiful November morning.
December.
December.
Number 343 to be exact, 22 days to the end of the year.
As I tell you all, don't get nervous about making mistakes in the air.
So we typically do a little banter in the morning and on this show, and we got a couple of things for you today. This day in history, 1965, a Charlie Brown's Christmas first premiered. How about that? Hard to believe.
Where do you come up with
44 years
with
ago?
These
Can
things?
You believe that?
Do you are you spending our company time doing this, Brad?
In 1987, Larry Bird ends his streak of 59 free throws in a row. There you go. There's your trivia for the day. Oh, and the best of all, it's your lucky day if you happen to be named Anna in Sweden and Finland, because today is Anna's Day. It celebrates everybody whose name is Anna in Sweden and Finland.
Thank you, Brad, for that information. I appreciate it.
I guess we should just get on with
it,
huh?
Yes, let's get on with the show.
We've got a great show this morning. We have with us in the studio today Nancy Kreisman. We have Don Kemp. We have Renee Cook and Taryn Westmoreland. So we got a full house this morning, Sam.
Yes, we do. It'll be a great show. I think the subjects are diverse and the information will be very informative.
So first up, we have Don Kemp. Don is the president of Southern Advisors Group. Good morning, Don.
Good morning. How are you, Brad?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you, and we appreciate you being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Don, let's just start. You're the president of Southern Advisors Group. Tell us a little bit about what you do with Southern Advisors Group, and tell us a little bit about how you came to be where you are today.
Well, that's an interesting story and probably too long for today. It's certainly nothing that I planned from the beginning. I can't take credit for a master plan, but as I look back, it seems like all of the steps lead me to where I am today. Basically, what I do today is help my clients identify and solve financial problems. And as I look back on the steps that it's taken me to get here, when I was in the Army, I enlisted in the Army right out of high school, and they taught me to lead people to accomplish the objective. And they were gracious enough to send me back to college, and I spent some additional time in the Army, and then I left for the corporate world. They taught me to manage resources, manage budgets, but again, to accomplish objectives. And then finally, in my church life, I was a Sunday school teacher, and I probably enjoyed teaching as much as anything. I mean, I really enjoyed being able to communicate transforming truths in a new and in an exciting way. So all of those together kind of prepared me for what I am today. If you said, are you ever going to be an insurance sales guy or a financial advisor, I would have said, not no, but heck no. But here I am today, and I absolutely love it. I wish I had done this 20 years ago.
Mm. That's a very, very interesting story. I love how it all goes back to the military, and everything you said through the stages was flavored with the military dialogue. Tell us what Southern Advisors Group, what is your specialties, what it is that you all do?
Probably the best way to describe that, Sam, would be a holistic financial planning group. We try and look at the big picture and realize that, some people, when they look at their advisors, they're all compartmentalized. They may have one insurance guy for that or an investment guy for this, or they've got three different accounts with internet investment advisors, and it's all compartmentalized. I had a lunch yesterday with an attorney, and he was saying that he has all the advisors in the world, but nobody is looking out for him in a proactive manner. So basically what we try and do is provide an overall look at the situation, identify problems, and provide solutions to those problems. Hopefully it's before the problem occurs and it's beyond the ability to do anything, but we try and take stages and help people all along the path.
When do you typically get first introduced to a client? What stage are they in, and what are they looking for? And when, and that's what's the reality, and then what would you prefer?
Well, it's easier when the clients are younger because obviously we have more time to put solutions and safeguards into practice. And typically, I have three target markets, if you will, professionals and business owners, because both of those groups at some point will retire, and then my other target market is retirees. So typically, I'll be introduced, about 70% of the people that I deal with are referred to me by a client or a friend. I'll be introduced for one specific issue. And then in the course of working with them on that, we'll develop a relationship and a feeling of trust, and then other problems just continue to surface.
So when you are introduced to a retiree, you know, clearly they've got a lot of road behind them, a lot of decisions have already been made. What can a retiree do to protect what they have and provide for the future?
Well, that's a great question, Brad. There are some things that, you know, you get beyond the point of being able to do anything about, but fortunately those are relatively few and far between. Let me give you an example of one of my older clients. I'll call her Mary, and she is 86, will be 87 next month. And she was referred to me by a friend of the family to talk about Medicare coverage. They were looking for something that would be less expensive and maybe provide equal or better coverage than she had at the time. And I was not able to help her at that time due to all the Medicare rules. But then they called me about 6 months later. We went back. We started working through different solutions. And I really think that I don't try and sell a solution, that I try and educate people about the options, and then once they're educated, they can pick the best one for their situation. So we went through several different options. She selected one. And then she had a question about life insurance. Now, you don't hear many 85, 86-year-olds talking about life insurance, but she had a question about life insurance. And it was a company that I was not with. I'm with about 20, but that was not one of them. We were able to get on the phone and negotiate through the company's voicemail and customer service, and it took about three or four phone calls and a couple of in-person meetings, but we were able to get an issue resolved for her that had been worrying her for some time. And once we finished that, she said, well, you know, what can you do? I've got some CDs, and the interest rates have dropped to almost nothing. What can you do on that? So we worked on some solutions as an alternative to her CDs. And basically, it was one thing after another. As we would solve one thing, she would raise another question, and then we would take that on sequentially. So we worked together for about a month and a half, and they're still in the family and working with them.
Don, it seems that with retirees specifically, you are working more to preserving what they have versus trying to create it.
Absolutely, and that's a good point. We do break the funds or the assets down into two areas. Typically, people are into the accumulation mode into their late 40s or early 50s, and, you know, starting at about age 50 or maybe 55 or as late as 60, people begin to think about preservation and distribution. I tell you, a lot more people are thinking about preservation today than they were a year and a half ago. But they're thinking about preservation. How do they preserve their assets? And one of the biggest issues that we get today is I'm worried about losing my assets if I have to go into a nursing home or assisted living or something like that. And I'm also worried about running out of assets. I'm running out of money before I run out of time. So we work with them on both of those areas, including long-term care on insurance, and other ways. There are solutions to help everyone with preservation of assets up to the time they're admitted to a nursing home. So regardless of health, there are solutions. Admittedly, there are fewer as you go farther down the road, but there are still solutions for almost every situation. And it is about preservation and distribution and making those assets last a lifetime to accomplish their objectives.
Recently, I've heard a number of people say 70 is the new 50. People are living longer, and they've got bigger concerns about outliving their money. And you and I were also talking the other day about how a lot of the market forecasters are predicting perhaps a significant correction yet to come. You know, what would you tell people with respect to what to do with their money now? And let's talk about somebody that, you know, is at 70 or so. What would you say to them?
Typically, I would say don't have anything in the market that you can't afford to lose. You know, when you're 40 and you lose 50% of your assets, you have time to recover. When you're 70, when you're already retired and drawing income, you know, those assets will never recover because you're drawing assets on a reduced base. So what I would tell people is take a look at making sure you've got the right amount of growth, because you will need growth to provide the income over a lifetime. Protection of principal, make sure your principal is protected, and then make sure you've got provisions in place to be able to guarantee some sort of income that fits your lifestyle for the rest of your life.
What type of instruments would fit the bill there?
Typically, there are a couple. One of the common solutions is an annuity. There are products called fixed or indexed annuities. And those provide some guarantees. They guarantee principal. They also provide some lifetime income guarantees. Depending on how they're structured and what the time frame is, there are different ways to set them up so that you can participate in market growth without necessarily the market risk. But it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's a case-by-case situation, going back to what their objectives are, what their time frame is, and then the assets that they have to work with.
Don, I have a background in the long-term care market, and I'd like for you to speak to that issue at a high level about when is the best time for individuals to start looking for long-term care, why should they be looking for it, and what are really some of the companies or policy provisions that they should be interested in?
Statistically, 84% of people who purchase long-term care do so before age 65. Typically, we'll see people in the 55 to 60 range that are really looking at it. If you look at group long-term care, the youngest person in the country on group long-term care is 24 years old. So, you know, it's always about competing priorities. I don't know that it's a very high priority for somebody in their 30s or 40s or early 50s, but the need is certainly there. It costs less. Some of the common provisions that I would look at, make sure that you have some sort of cost of living provision or adjustment in the policy. There are several ways to do that, and companies do them differently. But you want to make sure you have a cost of living projection, especially as you look at the projected increases in the cost of long-term care. You want to make sure that there is a provision for home care as well as facility care. You know, on a percentage basis, 30% of people will go into some sort of facility, so that means 70% of people are getting care in their home. And you really want to make sure that you've got home care covered. And then the daily benefit, and one of the things that I tell people is it doesn't have to cover everything. If you can take a portion of it, if the average cost is $150 a day and you're just covering $100 a day, well, that does a lot to preserve and extend your assets. And as a certified partnership long-term care specialist in the state of Georgia, even if you only purchase a policy with limited benefits, then that policy will also, if it's properly structured in the state of Georgia, it will at least preserve that amount of assets should you have to go into Medicaid.
Those are great, great points. My opinion is that in the next 10 to 15 years, there will be a financial crisis in the long-term care market, similar as there is today in acute medical setting. I know that it's hard for individuals to get their hands around that, but it's coming, and it's going to be greater. One of the issues that I'd like to speak of is a policy that guarantees or will at least have a provision for return of premium.
That's a good point, and it's one that is increasingly something that people really don't know to ask for it. But once you understand what the situation is, the most common thing that I hear is, but I'll never need long-term care. You know, my parents lived to be 70 or 75 and died peacefully in their sleep, and I'll never need it. So that individual, typically you can get about $3 of protection for about $1 of assets. And if you don't use it, depending on the company and how it's structured and the type of policy, there are a number of provisions to get those dollars back if you end up not using them.
So in the worst-case scenario, all you've done is lost the time value of the money as it's in there.
Well, you've lost the time value, but generally there is some interest accruing. So, one of the policies is, I think the current rate is 3.75%, which if you put a sum of money at 3.75, you've got
CD, right?
It's a CD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's better than a CD, and you've got 3-to-1 coverage on your assets.
Don, we heard you talk about your involvement in your church. Are there other causes that you'd like to talk about at all?
There are a couple, and Sam, like you said, I think Alzheimer's is one that will be more and more in our future as people age. As the projected lifespan grows, for someone being born today, the projected lifespan is almost 100. So, it really changes how we think about old age. Today, the projected lifespan is about 79 to 80. But you're looking at a lifespan extending 20 years beyond that. Here's another way to think about it. If you go to work when you're 20 and you work for 40 years until you're 60, and then you're retired for 40 years until you're 100, you're retired as long as you work. And we're just not prepared. We don't think about our assets in those terms today.
Oh, great point. Don, how can our listeners reach you?
Probably the easiest way is by phone. My phone is 678-860-4639 or by email at dkemp@brokersifs.com. dkemp@brokersifs.com.
And do you have a website?
I do not.
Okay. But they can reach you via email or via the telephone?
Email or phone.
Terrific. Well, Don, thank you again for being here with us
this
morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Our next guest is a geriatric care manager, and welcome Nancy Kreisman to the studio this morning.
Hi. Thank you for having me here today.
We're glad you could be here. I know you've been traveling. It's been a little bit hectic for you. You were actually attending a conference in Florida where it was sunny and warm, I imagine. Tell us a little bit about what you were doing down there. Do you mind?
Sure. I have a real passion for making sure that older folks get the very best possible care and that they have the best opportunity for quality of life. And it was very exciting. This conference down in Florida was put on by the Center for Positive Aging. And there were about 200 folks there from all over the world, actually, and all different disciplines. And the whole purpose of the conference was to talk about how to make sure that we continue to work on helping elders feel that their life has meaning and purpose and that they matter. And it was a very exciting conference.
So, based on what you just said, what was the takeaway for you? What were some of the things that stood out for you?
Well, one thing for sure that stood out for me was the whole notion of getting more intergenerational programming going on, that a lot of elders feel very segregated, and then they get stereotyped. And the same thing with kids. I mean, kids don't really know how to interact with elders, and elders don't really know how to interact with kids. And so one of the big thrusts of this conference was to talk about how we can bring everybody together and build community. And we're going to need to do that more and more as resources will be less limited and available to us. We're going to need to depend on community.
So, Nancy, first of all, tell us the name of your company. And you are a geriatric care manager, and some of our listeners may not have a good idea of what that is. So tell us the name of your company. Tell us a little bit about what you do as a geriatric care manager and maybe a little bit of the story of how you came to be doing that.
Sure. My name of my company is actually called Geriatric Consulting Services. And in a nutshell, I'm a little different from a geriatric care manager in that I have my, I'm a licensed clinical social worker and a marriage and family therapist. And so a fair amount of the focus on my practice actually is utilizing those skills and talents. And so I'm sort of known in the geriatric community. I've been in the community for 27 years, and I've had my practice about 15 years or so. So I'm sort of known as working with more of the sort of difficult, challenging family situations, which there are many of. And so I not only do I help do what some of the geriatric care managers do, which is finding resources and helping people find places to live, et cetera, but you can't do any of that if you've got a resistant elder or if you've got family feuding.
In contrast to a geriatric care manager, you're really a counselor, if I'm hearing it correctly.
Yeah, kind of. People sort of rely on me starting the whole process, getting, you know, helping them sit down and really talking through how do we move mom and dad when they're, you know, they're resistant. And then often it turns out that I end up working with that whole family and working with the service providers.
Well, why don't you, with that, tell us what are some of those services that you do provide and how you go about doing that?
Okay. And I also want to make sure, too, that I talk about what makes a good geriatric care manager, because one of my big thrusts is making sure that consumers have good information so that they can make the best choices possible. And the good news is that this is a growing field. The bad news is that a lot of people are jumping into this field that may not have background. And when people say, well, I took care of my mother for 3 years who had Alzheimer's, that doesn't quite cut it for me. And there are people that are calling themselves geriatric care managers that say that, you know, that's their background. So you've got to start out by, number one, finding out a bit about the individual and thinking about what your challenges are as well, because you want to try to match. And so what geriatric care managers or social workers can do for folks is to, there's so much information out there and there's so many websites and everything looks alike. I mean, you can go to 3 or 4 different websites and you're kind of getting the same information. And so a good geriatric care manager or a geriatric social worker can begin by, number one, helping you assess what you really need. And they do that, in my opinion, it's extremely important, particularly if you're dealing with a more complicated situation, that not only do you spend time asking the family for information, but you go see the elder. And to me, that's a very, very important part. Now, my practice, I sometimes consult with people that have elder family members that live in other places, Florida, California. And so what I then do is I try to get a social worker like myself involved with that elder that can do an assessment for me.
On-site, wherever they happen to be.
Absolutely. I've actually been flown to Florida once to evaluate a couple.
Wow.
But it's, to me, that is an critical part. If you're dealing with a kind of a more challenging situation.
So, and you said you have a tendency to deal with those challenging situations. How do you deal with a resistant parent?
I knew you were going to ask me that question. Woo. Well, it's not. I wish I could say there's a simple answer to it, but there really isn't. The way I work, that seems to work well, is that it's like anything. You have to go with the resistance. You don't try to go against it. And so the first thing I do is I try to ask the family for as much information about the elder as I can. So I take a really complete social history, get to know this individual. And then what we do is we try to talk about how to introduce me as and sometimes I don't go, you know, under the. I may be somebody that's, you know, just kind of a. I teach at Kennesaw State University, so I just wanted to interview this elder, for example. Mm-hmm. So I may not be quite up front and center all the time initially when I get in, but the most important thing is getting in. And then once I get in, I'm able to create a relationship pretty quickly with the elder, because when you make a home visit, you learn so much about the older person.
The old cells meet them on their home ground.
Awesome. Yeah. It's awesome.
You know, and I may blindside you with this a little bit, but it's something that's been on my mind. And let me just not bring the personal side of it into it, but suppose you have a family member who's still driving, and you got to have that difficult conversation about, you know, I don't think you should drive anymore. You've wrecked the car three times. Next time you could kill somebody. How do you have that conversation?
Nancy, I'll soften this for you. The way I did, Brad, is just flat out tell them that they couldn't come see me anymore. It didn't go over very well.
Exactly.
That's why you're not a geriatric care manager.
Exactly.
Well, again, there are a lot of different solutions, and it's really a case-by-case situation. We had this issue with my own father, who had some dementia from COPD and emphysema. So it was a lung disease kind of issue, and it was affecting his memory and his judgment and reasoning at times. And he was bumping into all kinds of stuff. And eventually what I suggested that my stepmom do with him was to talk to his physician. And really, if a person does have either a physical disability where they can't see well and they can't, you know, really work that car in the right way, or they have dementia, then it's ethically the responsibility, I put it back on the physician. A lot of families say, well, the physician won't do anything. The next step then, I mean, people do some creative things, particularly when they have people that have different kinds of cognitive challenges. I mean, they may tell the elder, they may put a flat tire on a few of the tires. They may, you know, try to hide the keys or do something to the car so that the car can't work, or take it into the mechanic and to say that it needs a lot of service. But really the best way is to try to partner with a doctor.
That has to be a very, very difficult situation, because in my mind, the car or removing the usage of that is the first step to taking away their freedom. And that's exactly what you don't want to do, nor what they want.
Yeah, I have a client right now, actually, that I'm working with that she still has her car, but she's got a lot of physical challenges right now. Cognitively, she's fine. And she's in her middle 80s, and she says, well, I'm just going to drive up the street to get my nails done. No big deal. But, you know, most accidents happen very close to home. So, and she's on a busy street on top of it, Roswell Road. So what I've tried to do with her, first of all, I got the doctor to team up with me. And the doctor basically said to her, you're on some medications, you know, you're still kind of wobbly, you shouldn't be driving. And we just keep on saying that. You know, and saying that to her, and that's sort of working. The other thing is I'm trying to help find her a driver. And actually what I try to do is match people with some of my students from Kennesaw. But young people, you know, are wonderful. They're looking to make some money, and it's a great combination.
Yeah, for a college student to drive and make money while they're doing it. Yeah.
You got that. So,
Nancy, tell us, if I am looking, if I have a parent who needs some assistance or some direction or help, how do I go about deciphering through all the gobbledygook to find the right geriatric care manager?
Well, there is a website just for geriatric care managers, and they can, you know, Google that website, and it will, you know, then they can say which location and that sort of thing. I'm actually not on it because I'm not a member of the National Geriatric Association. There's many reasons for it. But then the next thing to do is to Google geriatric social worker or geriatric counselor. But most importantly, I think, are the kinds of questions you want to ask to that professional. And some of the things that I have my clients, you know, I share with my clients about the kind of work I do is, one, you know, tell them what my degree is, to make sure that they understand my relationships with the places and the services that I refer to. I am fee-based. I get a little nervous about people that don't charge because they're getting money from these referral sources, and sometimes that can that can present an ethical challenge at times. And so it's just important, you know, to find out how people are paid. And then how do they work? And what kind of relationships do they have? You know, do they know about all the geriatric resources available? How often do they go into the communities that they're referring people to? What kind of relationship do they have with the geriatric doctors and the home care agencies and that sort of thing?
So I think what I hear you saying is there's a difference in the type of assistance you're looking for. So anybody would expect to pay a realtor based on, you know, how much a house sold for, et cetera, and you expect a realtor to behave a certain way. But if you're looking for some problem solving, you want to go to somebody that's paid on a fee basis that gets paid to spend time with you, not to point you in some other direction. Is that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are services that are fee-based, and Jenny, those folks tend to work with people that need more counseling, or the family situation's a little bit more challenging, and that's extremely important because then they can really do a counseling kind of piece to this whole thing, and generally they do go and do a home visit and talk with the medical folks and that sort of thing. There are some folks that just need to be referred to places, and therefore they don't really need a whole big workup.
Different sort of scenario.
Yeah, and they may not need to have to pay for the service.
Now,
if I'm looking for a geriatric care manager, and I'm going through all this list, what should I most expect? What should be the number one thing I should expect that geriatric care manager to do for us?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's extremely important that they do a good, interview with the family, mm-hmm. and find out, you know, who are the important players, because it's not always just the family. So that's number one, and get some idea, obviously, of what they're struggling with. A good geriatric care manager is going to, you know, the presenting problem is not always what the issue is. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to gather as much information as you can around that presenting problem and kind of dig a little deeper. It's not always just about finding a place for mom. And then secondly, like I said, I think it's terribly important that people go and visit with this elder, mm-hmm. and see them face to face and talk to the people around them. So that, to me, is... And then how are they going to put the plan in place, and how are they going to follow up with that plan, make sure it's happening?
And I suspect, and maybe you can confirm this and talk a little bit about it, but some people would look at your services and say, ooh, that's very expensive. You've got an hourly rate, and, you know, maybe not quite the level of an attorney, but still very expensive. But I suspect that what you can get done in a few hours could take the family weeks or months to do.
That's exactly the case. And quite frankly, the way I run my practice, if I need to have a sliding scale with folks, I will do that. I mean, I'm careful about it. Mm-hmm. I've done free work. I still do. I do pro bono work for the Alzheimer's Association and various people a lot of my colleagues who are therapists that refer people to me that can't afford. So, but you're right. I mean, it's not for everybody, and I realize I do cost, you know, and they can't get Medicare reimbursement for this.
Mm. But what you can get done in a few hours, though, maybe they couldn't even do themselves. So they don't have the skill or the capability.
And the other piece of it is the families are connected emotionally.
Yeah.
And so it's hard for them sometimes to navigate through, because they can't even think straight, you know. And really, I find a lot of my work that I'm doing lately is advocacy, is really pushing through some of the trying to get people out of the hospital is unbelievable now. Mm. It's so difficult, and getting the right services.
So, Nancy, if you what tip could you give for our listeners this morning?
The biggest thing I can say to people is you don't have to do this alone. And that's what I got from this conference. We've got to build community of support, circle of support around you, extremely important.
Very good. And we're about out of time, so how can our listeners reach you?
Well, there's two good ways. One is to call my cell, office cell, which is 404-881-0313. And the other way is to go onto my website, which is www.com. dot my name, Nancy, N-A-N-C-Y, Kreisman, K-R-I-S-E-M-A-N.com.
Very good. Well, thank you again for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy.
Okay, we are going to play a little bit of musical chairs here. We have Taryn Westmoreland from Senior,
Senior Lifestyle Connections.
Senior Lifestyle Connections. All right, so it's not just Sam that's making
mistakes. I'm glad it is a contagious disease.
And we have Renee Cook, who's also from the same company. But Taryn and Renee, welcome this morning.
Thank you.
You do slightly different things, correct?
Correct.
And while Renee is getting her headphones on, Taryn, tell us what you do for Senior Lifestyle Connections.
Well, I'm a senior advisor. I just help families locate any sort of assisted livings, personal care homes, private duty options, and also just kind of see if they are veterans to help with the side of the business that Renee does, helping them get that aid and attendance benefit.
So you had quite a drive this morning, didn't you?
We did.
You live in?
Commerce.
Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you cover.
That's a record.
Yeah, thank you for driving so far.
You're
to be
welcome.
Here. But you cover the entire Atlanta area? Do you cover beyond the Atlanta area?
We can do pretty much any state except Florida. The laws in Florida are just a little bit different. So we can help families anywhere else.
Can you tell us a little bit of the background of Senior Lifestyle Connections, how it started, and things of that nature? Who is the principal of Senior Lifestyle Connections?
Well, Tiffany Hager started the business, and she's worked with other companies that's helped families locate the assisted livings and things like that, and she's just always wanted to help families.
So how did you get involved with Tiffany in this business?
We are actually family down the line. Our husbands are actually related, so I've known her for a while, and I've always wanted to help families, however, not really the nurse-type material. So this way, I'm able to help families but not have to be really completely hands-on with the families.
We have with you Renee Cook, and I know that there's two distinct disciplines, if that's the correct terminology, that you all are in. So back to you, Taryn, tell us exactly what that discipline is that you are involved in, and we'll segue over to Renee.
Okay, well, I just talk with any families that are really, if they're not sure what they're looking for, they don't know if they need assisted living, private duty, anything like that. We help them locate that. We can look at any income levels, any areas, and just locate what they're looking for.
How do people find you? Not in terms of your phone number, but how do they become aware of your company?
We work with a couple of doctors that will refer to us. Word of mouth, a lot of families just hear about us from other families that have worked with us. And then just some of our advertisements.
And if I call you and I don't even know what it is that I need, what is the first thing? How do you start that process?
If they're not sure what they're looking for, we kind of start looking at what kind of care levels they have, what ADLs they need help with, and then what kind of budget, because that normally will narrow down the search area. Also, the area that they're looking in, that kind of helps us limit the amount of properties to pull.
Let's flip over to Renee. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning.
Did you two ride together this morning?
Yes, we did.
Okay, so you live up there in Commerce as well?
I do.
Okay, and you represent a slightly different part of the business.
I do.
So tell us what you do.
I help veterans and or their surviving spouses know whether they're eligible to receive the VA aid and attendance benefit, and if so, get the paperwork and everything that they need in order to apply.
Now, I think there are a whole bunch of people that aren't even aware that there is such a thing as a veterans aid and attendance benefit. Talk a little bit about what that is and the basic eligibility requirements.
All right. There is a pension available through the Veterans Administration for our veterans. And if they're married, the veteran and the spouse, or the widow of a veteran. they are also could be eligible if they meet the eligibility requirements. And the pension some of the criteria for being approved for the pension, they must be 65 or older, or else if they're younger than 65, must be deemed permanently disabled. The veteran must have served 90 days in the military, with one day falling during wartime. And then they must be needing help with their activities of daily living, which is sometimes referred to as ADLs. And they need to be needing help with at least two of those. It could be a little help, such as perhaps a widow who has anxiety about living alone. They may move into a retirement community, have a pull cord in the restroom and meals provided, or transportation, you know, somebody who's still somewhat independent, all the way up to someone in a nursing home who is totally dependent upon others to care for them.
And what can this money be used for?
The money is, if they are approved for the benefit, it's put into their account on a monthly basis for them to disperse at their will.
Let's go back to one of the qualifying events or qualifiers. You mentioned 90 days in the military and one day during wartime. Now, elaborate on that just a little bit, because I think that's important for our listeners.
Mm-hmm. The VA has recognized the wartime dates.
Do they have to be in the war zone?
No, sir. They do not. They could have been stateside, never have left the states. They could have had a desk job. They just need to be termed active military for 90 days, with one of those days falling in a wartime period that's recognized by the Veterans Administration.
Do you see many veterans that were not active during wartime?
I've had two or three, but for the most part, most are. The Vietnam War, some people who went in earlier, say 61 to 64, it is considered the Vietnam conflict, and the VA does not recognize those years as wartime. They start the Vietnam War with 1964.
So I think this actually highlights a little bit of the reason that you exist, because filling out this paperwork, mm-hmm. knowing who might be eligible, who won't be eligible, is complex. Mm-hmm. And somebody that was in that conflict in 1962, for example, mm-hmm. might go through the whole process and then find out they're not eligible.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that process. And again, you know, I mean, I said a little bit of it, but why should somebody seek help to navigate through this application process?
I believe we've made it very user-friendly. Someone will contact me either by email or by a phone call, and I will get in. We'll converse, and I'll go through the checklist with them, some of the things that I've already mentioned. There are a couple more that I have not yet mentioned. And so I can determine by talking with them if they meet the criteria. And based on the information they've given me, I can let them know that they should or may not be approved, and it either worth trying to apply or not. And so, again, I believe we've made the process very user-friendly. We can provide them with all the paperwork if they apply, and we have a very simple step-by-step guide that goes through the application. And I send everything to them by email. And so I'm able to – they just simply open the attachments and print them off, and they have the application, the supporting documentation, a checklist of everything that they need to put in the packet that they mail to the VA when they apply.
To give our listeners a flavor for the complexity of this, how many pages is that application, roughly?
I would say 10, perhaps, okay. But then there are a couple of supporting documentations. They must have a physician's statement confirming, indeed, that they do need help with their activities of daily living, and then their medical expense report. And the way the VA benefit is determined, it is an income to medical expense ratio.
So is there a means test, I guess, is that?
It's very simple. If they're spending 100% of their monthly income, their monthly taxable income, on their medical care, such as living in an assisted living community, with their insurance premiums, doctor copays, anything that they spend monthly for which they're not reimbursed or is not covered by insurance, if they're spending 100%, they could be expect to be approved for 100% of the benefit.
And is it similar to the Medicaid program where the assets, they have to spend down their assets before they become qualified?
The VA will allow a married couple to have up to $80,000 in assets, and an individual, such as a surviving spouse, may have up to $40,000 in assets.
Now, does that include?
Does not include their home, car, or personal possessions. If they have above the limit of assets, we recommend them to seek counsel from an elder law attorney or a financial planner, someone who can arrange for asset protection. There is no look-back period. And so there are options if their assets are above it, provided that they're spending the 100% of their monthly income on their basic medical care.
So that no look-back period, that's a distinct difference from Medicaid and actually a very important
point.
That's
my understanding.
And what are the actual benefits available, the dollar amounts? Okay.
For the year 2009, a veteran, if they're approved for 100%, could receive up to $1,644 per month. A surviving spouse or widow could receive up to $1,055 per month. And a married couple could receive up to $1,949 per month. And if both spouses are still living, even if only one of them needs assistance with their care, they still must apply as a couple.
Now, what if they're both veterans?
They would apply separately, independently.
So they could potentially get 3288.
Yeah.
Correct.
That will go a long way to paying for some of these.
It can make a difference in someone's quality of life. And like they were saying, they could allow them to stay in their assisted living community or, you know, to give them like a better quality of life.
Let's go back over to Taryn. Taryn, tell us what is it that you find, what recharges your batteries on a daily basis in what you do? What is it you find rewarding?
Just after you've helped locate a property for a family that was pretty much at the end of the road. They didn't know where to go, didn't know who to call. They're kind of calling you as a last resort. Just the thanks that you get from them, the relief that you can hear the relief in their voice after they've placed that loved one.
So you have a tendency to be the arms and legs of the family, so to speak, right? Because you've been in these facilities that they might be referred to. You've met with the private duty companies that you might refer to. So tell us a little bit about how you evaluate the facilities and obviously. Well, it's maybe not obvious. My understanding of your compensation structure is that the facilities and the private duty organizations pay a referral fee, but you're evaluating those facilities and those companies as well. Tell us a little bit about how you do that.
Well, we definitely look on the state website, kind of keep a check on licensure, make sure there's not very many make sure when they've had their inspections, there hasn't been many things against a property. Sometimes it's tough to keep up with personal care homes in Gwinnett County because there are lots of them. So we just also want our families to get back with us. If they did have a problem with a property, or if they've had a family member or any other friends that have had problems with properties, we like to know those stories because, like I said, with the personal care homes, it's very tough to get to every single one of them on a regular basis. So we just, you know, get that feedback from the families.
If Taryn, if I have a family member that needs assistance, is there a piece of advice you might give that family member?
Definitely just do your research. And, you know, talk with people, talk with the properties. We do tell a lot of families that are a little hesitant about making a decision. We tell them, just go tour the property without calling ahead. Just kind of show up so that you can see how they work on a daily basis.
And if the clients have questions about the facilities when you interview them, do you kind of find out what they're looking for? And are you able to kind of point them in a direction based on what their needs are?
Yeah, we definitely look at what their needs are, look at kind of what they're looking for. Some of our more independent people, they're looking for more places that'll take their pets or that have certain activities that they enjoy. So for those people, we actually look at the social side of it as well as the care needs.
I'm sure it can be bewildering. As you mentioned, there are a lot of personal care homes. I know when I look in some of the resource guides how many home care companies there are, and I'm sure it can be bewildering. And so you kind of are helping narrow down what could be a very daunting task for a family member.
Correct. And with a lot of families that maybe have low incomes, they can find, it's very easy for them to find the assisted living names. So a lot of them have called assisted livings that are way out of their price range. So a lot of times that's where we come into play. We can find the small personal care homes that have the, that can take them at their income level.
Okay, Renee, if I have a veteran who needs assistance, what advice may you give that veteran as they start this process?
They're welcome to give me a call, and I'll be glad to walk with them through the process, help them know if they're eligible, and then I can provide them with everything that they need in order to successfully apply.
So it sounds like your tip is similar to Nancy's, which is don't go it alone.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. I believe we've made it much more user-friendly to make it in layman's terms so they can go down line by line and know exactly what the information is that the VA is looking for.
Tell us what is a reasonable timeline expectation from the time they start the paperwork to when the benefits may be typically be approved.
Once they submit their paperwork to the VA, they should receive some kind of notification within 4 to 6 weeks, letting them know that they got it. The VA will take them from there and walk them through the remaining process. They may need more documentation, if they may need clarification. It just depends on how accurately the family members did their paperwork. We never ask for personal information, account numbers, social security numbers, so I never actually put my eyes on their application. I tell them what we do it by phone. I tell them what needs to go on the application. So based on what they actually put on paper is how the VA determines their eligibility. So it is possible that if, you know, they did not complete something accurately, it can cause delays. But hopefully if they did everything accurately, they should know within 3 to 6 months whether they've been approved. The good news is once you submit your application, your benefit will be retroactive back to the first day of the month following the month that you apply. For example, if someone sends in their application in the month of December, their benefit would be retroactive back to January 1st of 2010.
Good.
What's the fastest you've ever seen anybody
within
approve?
3 months.
Really?
I understand. My understanding is the more dire cases do get a little more preferential and attention. Do you think that's the case, Taryn? Is that true?
3 months is about the quickest.
Yeah.
So more really realistically, let's say 5 to 6 months. Is that realistically?
Well, we're now using the VA regional offices instead of the local offices.
Mm-hmm.
There's only 3 of them, so we have them mail it directly to the regional office. Going through the regional office, we have not had a family have to wait longer than 3 months.
Oh, okay, good.
So they're
good.
Getting their approval letter right about the 3 month mark, and then a couple weeks later they get their check.
Terrific.
How could our listeners contact you, whether they have a veteran or just a loved one needing some resources?
The toll-free number for both companies is 866-966-6323, and our website is seniorlifestyleconnections.com, and there is a link on there to the VA website as well.
Very good. Well, thanks to both of you again for being here this morning, and thanks for driving so far.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you to Nancy and Don as well for being here. And thank you to the listeners for tuning in this morning. To listen to this broadcast after the fact, you can go to www.ugeriaradio.com. And remember, if children are our nation's greatest asset, seniors are our nation's greatest treasure. Tune in at the same time next week for another great edition of Ujiria Radio.
Ujiria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and is recorded in the Business Radio X Studios.